thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 35 for the 23rd of December, 2008. Year in Review. I'm Dan Cohen. Happy holidays from the entire Digital Campus crew, including me, Dan Cohen, and Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
Hope everything's going okay on the pirate seas over there.
Everything's going very well here in the land of the pirates.
The land of the pirates. Maybe we'll have to talk about that at some point on a future podcast. But for those who are listening in real time, you might want to take a look at a story about Mills Kelly and his famed pirates on Chronicle's homepage, the Chronicle of Higher Ed's homepage. Well, it is the end of 2008, and as we've done every year, can we say that now that this is our second year, as we did last year at this time, we are going to do our year in review and the top 10 stories as seen by the three of us, at least, the top 10 stories in technology, the internet, new media, and of course, education, academia, libraries, and museums. So it'll be a fun top 10 here, and we will climb the mountain up to number one. Of course, if you think we left out a story, please do comment at digitalcampus.tv on some technology and education stories that you thought were important. We'd love to continue the discussion online. So, Tom and Mills, it's been an exciting year here on the podcast, and a lot of things happening in technology and libraries, museums, and universities and colleges. Why don't we start with, speaking of universities and colleges, at number 10 we have a real expansion in open educational resources, and especially things like video and audio podcasts or YouTube videos of professors. Seems like a growing trend. I mean, even just this last week, the old ladies of British education, Oxford and Cambridge, started putting podcasts online, including luminaries like Joseph Stiglitz talking about the global credit crunch. Mills, you've been a big proponent. Indeed, you've podcasted yourself. Do you think this is going to expand in 2009? And how important was it in 2008?
Well, first of all, in terms of how important it was in 2008, I actually started, I think, in 2007 with a simple setup, just using my iPod and a little iMic plug-in and a little like $19 lavalier that I attached to my lapel. And I can create really simple and easy podcasts that I upload immediately. And so it's an incredibly simple process that some people would like to make really complicated. But and these are, you know, perfectly good audio quality podcasts. And my students really, really appreciate it, because if they, you know, if they miss a class for some reason, or there was something in class they want to go back to, they don't have it in their notes, they can just go and download the podcast. And listen to the lecture. They don't get the interaction that goes on in the classroom. They don't see any slides that I put up on the screen or anything like that, but they get the audio track for the class, at least of me. My mic doesn't pick up other people in the room very well. So it works great. And I think it's so simple and so easy to use now that and so appealing to students, especially at places like George Mason, where the students, you know, they work for a living, they don't live on campus very much, or not very many of them live on campus, and so it's a great resource for them, and it's too easy not to do it in some ways.
And you haven't found your students abandoning the class wholesale?
No, because for one thing, I don't post up the podcast for every single class, only because I don't lecture all the time. I guess if I was lecturing every single class, then I might see that kind of abandonment. But, you know, in a Monday, Wednesday, Friday class, I probably lecture on Monday and maybe every other Wednesday. And the rest of the time is discussion of readings and things like that. And that does not get podcast because you can't easily podcast a discussion, and so you can't easily record the discussion. So, you know, they might abandon the lecture class some, but I haven't noticed any drop off in attendance.
Is this something that, I mean, it looks to me like just browsing through these Oxford and Cambridge podcasts, tends to be the luminaries on campus. In a sense, it's PR for the university. I think we've discussed that before. The Yale podcast, for instance, are, you know, the really great teachers and very sexy course titles like The Philosophy of Death and these sorts of things. Is this something that, but, you know, on the other hand, there are universities, I believe like Berkeley, that are capturing the entirety of their faculty's lecturing, or will in the next couple of years, which is, I think, why we have to have it on our top 10 this year. Is this something that will spread more widely, or will be sort of balanced between PR versions of this and more comprehensive versions?
Well, I think the more staid universities are going to take it slower, and I think we've seen that with, you know, Berkeley was an early adopter of this, you know, YouTube technology and this channel for reaching out to its constituencies. You know, I think Oxford and Cambridge, it's taken those universities a little longer to come around to it. But I do think it's going to end up being, you know, once they get comfortable with it, it's going to end up being more and more widespread within the universities. And I think, you know, just, it's not just video, although I think video is where this has gotten the greatest head start and where we see the most activity. But I comes to mind other kinds of open resources from universities and collecting institutions. We saw a lot of activity on Flickr this year with Boston Public Library and New York Public Library joining the Flickr Commons, which is kind of the same idea. It's releasing, content from the institution, branded content from the institution on one of these more open, more popular, more Web 2.0 kinds of media sharing services. So I think this is definitely a trend that's going to continue and has really, I think, entered the mainstream. While it was really new in 2007, in 2008, I think it's really entered the mainstream.
Well, speaking of entering the mainstream, at number 9, we have a story that probably some in our audience might not think is a story because we didn't hear a lot about it, but to us it sort of indicates a transformation of the views of this entity, and that's, of course, Wikipedia going mainstream. We didn't hear a lot of griping about Wikipedia, did we, in 2008?
Very little, very little. In fact, you know, we looked back before we started the podcast today and noticed that our first podcast was Wikipedia Friend or Foe, and you know, people just can't seem to work themselves up about it anymore. And so I think it really has, in many ways, made it into the mainstream.
I agree. We haven't heard much about it. And what we have heard about it is the kind of news that puts it in the mainstream. For instance, the Wikipedia was awarded a major, major grant from the Sloan Foundation, which is one of the kind of old school New York foundations that doesn't tend to fund these kinds of things unless they are in the mainstream. And so I think, you know, Wikipedia has come into its own as a somewhat respectable academic resource. So I think definitely we're going to see more of that in the next year.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of grants, so Wikipedia, just recently they received a very large grant to transform their interface so that it's more usable by, you know, newbies, by new editors of Wikipedia articles. And I think the idea is that, you know, as it's grown, surely there's a core of Wikipedians, you know, 5 or 10,000 who really do most of the edits on the site, but that they want to get more people involved, the casual visitor who, you know, knows something to add to an article. And you know, if you've never added to a wiki, it's a little bit intimidating. And so they're doing I think it's about a $900,000 project to work on the interface a little bit on MediaWiki, which is the underlying software that runs Wikipedia and a lot of other wiki sites, to just make it a lot easier to just drop in and do an edit, to register, to participate in Wikipedia. And to me, again, that's, I think, pretty indicative of it. I have to say, just personally, I find myself going to Wikipedia more and more, you know, obviously taking some articles with a grain of salt, but, you know, for most things, it's a quick check of a topic. You know, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, I looked up this morning because I didn't really know how it functioned that well. And, you know, Wikipedia was sort of the first place I thought to go to, and the article was quite good. Okay, let's move to number 8. And it seems to be something that, that we've been tracking now for the past couple of years, and that has to do with academic and other kind of cultural heritage conferences in the library and museum world, in addition to the professional disciplines of academia. Conferences are changing, and we have at number 8 unconferences entering the academy. Of course, we at the Center for History and New Media run an unconference on technology and learning and what's going on in library and museums called That Camp, the Humanities and Technology Camp. But it's starting to infect, if we can use that word, other, I guess, more mainstream conferences as well, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, one thing we saw this year and which I had a little bit of a hand in was the Oral History Association. They moved at least part of their conference format to a more of an unconference or bar camp type format, informal is probably not the word, but a more open, I would say, format. I think we're also seeing in the campus technology fields, in the museum and library technology fields, a huge growth of this kind of gathering. I think Code for Lib this year was very successful. Our own CH&M's own Dave Lester has started a series of WordCamp Ed conferences. They're under the WordCamp, WordPress Camp banner, but just focusing on educational technology. There was one in Fairfax where we are this fall, but there's going to be others up in Worcester, Massachusetts at Holy Cross, one in Vancouver, and others. So I think we've seen in the library, museum, education fields a lot of movement towards this unconference format, either a dedicated unconference or add-ons to more traditional conference programs. I think Mills, you've also been involved with sort of working with a more traditional society to add some unconference elements to its program, right?
Right. Yeah, a colleague of mine, Kevin Krause at Wayne State, convinced the Slavic Studies Association, the AAASS, to add an unconference track in the annual meeting. So, you know, we only have 3 slots in the program for the coming year, but it's billed as an experiment. And I think we'll probably see some fairly enthusiastic response from people, in which case then we can start adding more slots in the program.
It seems like there's just a general negative reaction, 15, 20 years into the web age, against the kind of in-person, delivery of papers, the panel format that all these conferences used to have. And that seems to be really what's behind this, right? As different kinds of modes of communication increase online, it just seems really staid and actually pretty unproductive to have a regular kind of conference where papers are sort of droned and the audiences sit there and then react after an hour.
Well, I think one of the things
more
is
participatory.
Yeah, it's so much easier to share that content, the content that you would have delivered in person at a podium reading a paper. It's so much easier to deliver that content ahead of time in a blog, in a chat room, on a wiki, and get the conversation, get to the discussion portion of the panel even before you get to the conference itself. And so when you actually meet in person, you've already gone through all the preliminaries of, understanding what this person thinks and what that person thinks, and you can jump right into the discussion. Which I think we've all thought is the most interesting thing about going to conferences, not listening, sitting quietly and listening to papers. So the technology has allowed us to kind of bypass some of the more formal aspects of conferencing and to focus on what really I think we all would admit are some of the most productive aspects of the conferences, which are the conversations that happen in the hallways, the conversations which happen after papers are read. So the technology just allows that to happen a little more efficiently, and I think the conference organizers are recognizing that with changes in the format.
Yeah. And I think Tom, you're being polite. I think we have to just agree that most academic conference panel presentations are about as boring as dirt. And so people are just tired of it. And as our colleague Roy Rosenzweig pointed out years ago, the last great innovation in the AHA conference was the American Historical Association annual meeting, was to add a discussant to the panel, which just meant that then there were four papers instead of three. So speaking as somebody who's chaired I don't know how many academic panels over the years, I'm so looking forward to not having to slide that little piece of paper across the table to the speaker saying 5 minutes left and then 2 minutes left and then stop talking. So I think that once people, you know, people who want to exchange ideas, once they see how well this works, then they're going to move rapidly toward other sorts of models of scholarly communication.
Yep, agreed. Okay, at number seven, moving up the list, we have the rise of ebooks and devices like the Kindle, which, you know, I think finally started to make some inroads. We still don't have final sales figures on the Kindle, but it's certainly talked a lot about in the academy and among publishing houses and all the academic publishing houses, certainly, thinking about electronic publication. Reading is changing, right? And kinds of publication are changing. We've talked a lot about it on the podcast this year. Where do we see this going? And what has happened this year that that has maybe pushed this more into the realm of possibility for the future and the ultimate death of perhaps books on paper? If we think that.
Well, I think the Kindle really is the big development, that there's an affordable, relatively affordable, $300 or $400 device that has an internet connection, makes it easy to obtain these books, formats them correctly, and is on sale through, you know, the world's largest retailer, I guess, outside of Walmart. You know, that has pushed it into the mainstream. It's a device that you can easily get and that works and is fairly intuitive to use. You know, there have been ebook readers around for a long time, but the Kindle, I think, really has changed the game somewhat. And I think we're seeing new things. Kindle's going to come out with a new version. They're going to come out, it sounds like, with a textbook version of the hardware. It also seems like we're seeing things like flexible, paper-like screens, displays, electronic displays that you could, you know, fold up and put in your bag, that would make it easy to read something like a newspaper while you're on the subway or sitting at lunch. So, you know, I think the technology here, the hardware in some ways, is driving this shift and changing the way we read. And I think with continued changes in the hardware, we're going to see more and more of this.
Yeah, and I think the other big thing about the Kindle is that it demonstrated that there is a market for this kind of thing. And so given that there is a market, then that starts driving more innovation. Other people start saying, ah, I could actually make money doing this. And so then they start coming up with improvements. So I think we're going to see a lot more.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think one of the stories that might be driving this is also what's going on in the newspaper world, where, you know, just this week, both of the major Detroit newspapers basically cut way back on their home delivery of paper newspapers. I think one cut back to 2 days a week and the other one cut back to 3 days a week delivery. And it's really probably, you know, pretty close in the next few years of the end of a lot of these, you know, physical deliveries of newspapers. And you know, at the same time, a lot of these big newspaper houses are experimenting with, I think, a new, you know, a Kindle-like device for delivery of the paper, you know, which saves them all the gas and the printing costs, which are enormous, and paper and ink costs are enormous. And, you know, I think that will, you know, getting that kind of a device, which then can be repurposed for reading of PDFs and books and other form factors, will certainly accelerate the trend.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The other thing driving this is the economics of publishing. I think we're seeing that too in university presses, which we saw this year started looking seriously at ebooks for their back catalog. I think, you know, another example of a paper that has really is ceasing its print publication is the Christian Science Monitor. They're going to an all online format. So I think absolutely the combination of improved hardware and the economics of print publishing have really pushed this over the course of the last year.
At number six, taking a different turn, although I guess it's a little bit related, I suppose we all read our newspapers frequently online and in a web browser. And at number six, we have really the kind of reignition of the browser wars. Real strong competition this year in browsers that I think, you know, we've all noticed is probably going to have a pretty significant effect on the way, you know, we do our work in libraries and museums and the academy. With the probably the most the marquee story here would be the launch of Google's own browser, Chrome. But Firefox 3 launched, and there were major updates to Opera, and Internet Explorer sent out a beta of 8 that really had significant improvements. And so there's a lot of activity here. I suppose. Particularly, and maybe this is just focusing too much on the technology, real emphasis on the execution of code within the browser. So specifically things like JavaScript rendering, or execution, which really helps out with web applications and makes all of those things like Gmail, for instance, feel more like a desktop app. I think we're going to have more to say on this coming up on the list. But what are your thoughts, Tom Mills, about Chrome and its effect on this market, and in general, the significance of this in universities and colleges?
I think that the big thing is not so much going to be the desktop innovation for the browsers, but the mobile innovation, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But I'm one of those people. I'm happy with my web browser as it works right now, and so I'm waiting for not for the current browser war, but the next one, where something really big and different happens. This to me seems like a lot of kind of nibbling around the edges of slight improvements here and there, and so I'm just kind of happy with the way my browser works at the moment.
I'd point to, I think, Dan, like you, I'd point to the improved JavaScript rendering of these new browsers. I mean, that's really, I think, Google's point in releasing Chrome is to make the experience of using web applications more like the experience of using a desktop application. I think we're seeing also sort of standalone sort of runtime web engines, things like Adobe Air, Mozilla Prism, and in fact with Google Chrome, you can save any web service, Gmail or Backpack or one of these JavaScript heavy web services as an application. So it will sit on your desktop and run as a sort of standalone web application in its own window from your desktop. And I think these new browsers are really starting to make a big difference in shrinking the distance between the web and the desktop, and we're starting to see that in a lot of areas, I think some of which we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah, I would totally agree. I think that's a really important trend about what's sometimes been called single site browsers. So it's sort of a web window that really is just functional for a single site, whether it be Gmail or Twitter, for instance. There are which I have a feeling we'll talk about in just a minute, but these browser-like things like Adobe Air, where you can create an application which is basically just dedicated to interacting with and displaying information from a particular website. And so really it does blur the lines between what's a web application, what's a desktop application, what's a mobile application. All of these things start blending together because of this. So I think there's going to be a lot to look forward in browsers. Well, I guess I spilled the beans already on number five here. Twitter, Mills, you can start griping at this point. But at least Tom and I, two-thirds majority of the Digital Campus team, agreed that 2008 was a good year for Twitter. I've certainly noticed that recently. I've had a lot more followers and just traffic on my feed from Twitter. I guess more in generally, I guess we could say microblogging has really taken off in the year, but Twitter's really the key piece of this. Tom, what did you see? I mean, you've been on Twitter for quite some time. It took me a while to buckle under. Did you see major changes in the activity on Twitter and how it was being used in the academy and in the library and museum communities?
Yeah, I think I saw two. I think I saw two things in this kind of Twitter microblogging space. On Twitter this year, I think the big difference between 2008 and 2007 was the adoption of Twitter by institutions. It used to be that like all my Twitter friends were people, and they had their own individual handle, and they were Twittering from just their own personal thoughts and activities and whatever. Over the course of the last year, I've gotten a lot of friends like the National Museum of American History and the there are a lot of institutional Twitter accounts out there now where they're broadcasting new developments, openings of exhibits, new products, new services. They're using it much more as a kind of PR tool, but in a way, like a sort of a more useful PR tool than just sending out a press release. It gives you a link. It tells you it's much more fine grained. You hear about developments sort of as they're happening. They're announcing developments that you might not have heard of that aren't quite worthy of a major press release, but are interesting in that they're kind of micro constituencies might be interested in hearing about. So I'm seeing much more of that. That's the first thing. I think the second thing I think we're seeing, and maybe this is more of a prediction for 2009, are internal microblogging services. So that I think we're going to see a lot, and we're starting to see it a little bit already, are dedicated, private, closed microblogging platforms, microblogging networks within institutions as a way of, as you know, sort of another channel in addition to email and IM for sharing information about what various teams are doing, for broadcasting institutional information. So I wouldn't surprise me to see in 2009 some universities and some bigger libraries and museums launching internal microblogging networks to tie their staff together more effectively and to create ad hoc working groups and other things.
But I'm still not going to do it.
We'll see. This time next year, look for our year-end review 2009 to see if we get Mills to buckle under. At least get your name. I mean, you should reserve your user account name, Mills. Don't you think?
Nah.
Oh, I'm going to go take Ed Wired right now and then ransom it to you when you decide to come on.
Right.
Yeah, but see, if I got the name, that would just be the first step on the slippery slope.
I think we should get Mills Kelly and just start tweeting all kinds of things. Like, you know, there was that Sarah Palin Twitter account that was just making stuff up, which was hilarious for a while. Okay, let's move on as Mills sort of grinds his teeth through number five, Twitter, on to number four, netbooks. This is something I really didn't anticipate at all. I think, Tom, you had started to talk about this last year, but the notion of a really lightweight laptop that's pretty stripped down, that really gets its power from what's online. So if you're using Gmail or the Google suite of online docs, what more do you need? Do you need a web browser? You need a you know, a little bit of RAM to kind of run these things. You don't need that much local storage because you're not doing a lot on it with, you know, video editing or anything that takes a lot of processing power. And so you can strip down the laptop to just its essentials and make it under 3 pounds, really lightweight to carry around. It's our sense, right, that this is going to be a big story on campuses. Students carrying these things around, they're already using pretty much nothing but some kind of online email and things like Facebook that are all online.
Yeah, they're super cheap. They're pretty nice. They have good displays. They have reasonably sized keyboards. It's kind of like a halfway device between a full-size laptop or a desktop computer and a touchscreen mobile phone, which, you know, doesn't really have the kind of keyboard interface that a lot of people are looking for to do more serious work. I think it's taken off already. I think last year this time we were talking a lot about the OLPC, the XO, the one laptop per child, and they had a deal. I guess it was this time last year where you could, you know, you would buy one for yourself. You'd get one for yourself, and one you would buy one for a child in the developing world. And you know, I think in the last year we've seen kind of not much activity with one laptop per child. There's not a ton happening there. It doesn't seem like, or at least it hasn't had the impact, the direct impact that I think we probably expected. But they kind of showed the way towards a lower cost, lighter weight kind of laptop computer that has an idea that now has been taken up by all the major and even not so major hardware manufacturers. So we now see, you know, HP's got one, Dell's got one, Asus has got one. They sort of started it, but Acer has one. You know, most of the major hardware manufacturers are just putting these things out and competing fiercely for the price point. And you know, we're seeing them down into the $200 range. So I think we're gonna see more of that. And I just saw, in fact, this week my first student carrying around one of these. There was a student in our Johnson Center, the kind of campus center, carrying one of these things around. I think it was the HP. And so I think it really is a story for 2008 and going to be a big one in 2009.
Really makes sense for a student.
I would agree.
Yeah. I mean, the only issue, of course, is you got to be online because it really, I mean, as the name says, it's a netbook and you need the net. But, you know, with ubiquitous computing and ubiquitous Wi-Fi on campuses and, you know, maybe that's not a big deal in 2009. You certainly can see it. I mean, I've noticed, you know, I noticed the switch to Macs when I would go to conferences, and all of a sudden I noticed everyone would open up their laptop, and the rise of the Mac as it took over a lot of market share from PCs. And now, just recently in the last year, I've noticed going to a lot of these conferences that people open up netbooks more and more. Undoubtedly will be a big story in 2009. Well, we're to our top three. These are all big stories, I think, and not unrelated. But at number three, something we just talked about a couple of podcasts ago in Digital Campus 33, the Google Books settlement and related stories about mass digitization, which was also one of our stories to watch from the Year in Review from 2007. But we've been really looking at this, and I think, you know, one of the big stories, pieces of this, is that Microsoft dropped out of its mass digitization program, sort of abandoning its equipment where it lied. And Google Books, you know, toward the end of the year, made this major settlement with the Authors Guild and the American Association of Publishers, which I think is going to have a huge impact on what goes on in, you know, the education space. What are we going to see from this? What's the outcome of these, of where these mass digitization programs have ended up, one in settlement and the other one gone, and also, of course, what's going on with Open Content Alliance reaching 1 million books that are freely open and available this year?
I think we're going to see licensing deals starting to surface that offer universities like ours, for instance, with a relatively small library collection, access to, you know, the full corpus of the Google Books project for a fee. I think fee for service is next.
I mean, this makes Google a vendor, doesn't it? I mean, in the same way ProQuest would be a vendor of educational content. But yeah, I mean, I was walking by our library the other day and thinking, okay, there are 1 million volumes. I mean, it's a decent sized library, but it's, you know, a fraction of the size of the University of Michigan library, which is being digitized by Google. And Google already has 7 million books. So when we get that licensing contract at some point in the next year or two, when this class action settlement is fully approved by the judge and Google starts sending out these licensing notice or marketing that, what happens? Doesn't this kind of crush physical libraries at 90% or more of the universities that have really small collections if they can give their students an account to log into to get access to all this stuff online?
You know, I think it's not going to crush the libraries. Instead, I think it's going to make it possible for them to focus on which physical resources they really need, because for sure there still need to be physical resources close at hand. I mean, there are a variety of for instance, you know, maps. It's great to see maps online, but maps are also they're objects that have texture. They're not just a picture. They're a physical thing as well. And libraries still have pretty good sized map collections. And so that's one thing. You know, I think they'll just start focusing more on what is it that we absolutely have to own, because now we don't have to own all of these books. So I think in the end it's going to help them.
Right. And I guess what unique collections each library has, special collections, greater emphasis on those things and things that might not ever get digitized.
Sure. I mean, you know, just even our small library here at George Mason has some really nice special collections. But I'm sure that aspect of the library is always in sort of a constant fiscal struggle with the imperative of buying more and more books. And so I don't think we're going to stop buying books, but I think it will make it possible for us to buy fewer and then spend more of that money on things like special collections.
Right. Well, we'll have an upcoming podcast on the financial Armageddon and what it means for academia. But it does seem like you know, with what's going on right now with the finances of the university, that you know, buying every $120 Cambridge University Press book seems like a pretty easy thing to cut when you can grab 7 or 8 or 10 million books for probably pretty, you know, a relatively low cost when you think about it from a Google vendor or whatever this entity that gets set up by Google will charge. Okay, well, speaking of financial Armageddon and the impact it's having on campus, at number two, we really have something that we started to talk about earlier in this podcast, certainly relates to netbooks, but also just relates to the functions that a university should be doing. You know, we just talked about how perhaps a university or most universities will no longer be in the book collecting business. It now is a little unclear to us at number two is whether we'll start outsourcing and abandoning certain functions to the cloud. We saw the story that Boston College has sort of abandoned the idea of hosting its own email service. Cloud computing at number two, big story this year, hasn't it?
I think it has been. I think that the BC story really is indicative of a larger trend more and more universities are moving to MSN or Google Gmail or Yahoo Mail for their email services. So sort of Google apps for your domain kind of thing. And the BC story is just further proof of this, that students are arriving on campus with the tools, many of the tools that they need that the university used to have to provide. So a student ends up on campus with an IM account and with at least one email account and with the social networking tools that they have. They have all of this kind of infrastructural stuff already. And so it seems like, you know, sort of duplicating what those things that they already have, spending all this money on duplicating services that they're already using, and which they've chosen and which they prefer. I think we all know that students would prefer to use their personal email accounts than the one given to them by the university. I think we're just going to see more and more of this. It'll be interesting, I think, to see whether this trend extends to the Office suite of applications, whether things like Zoho and Zimbra and Google Apps really take off, really displace Microsoft, the Microsoft Office suite, in the way that it seems like Gmail and Yahoo Mail and Windows Live are the email systems that campuses are running. I think that's what we should be on the lookout for 2009.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a real trendsetter here is USC, the University of Southern California. You know, after 10 months of discussion and debate about it and a lot of time implementing, I don't know if there are other universities that have done this, but they've actually implemented Google Apps for Education for their 30,000 students, and surely that's a leading indicator. There's going to be other universities that will start implementing it. I mean, surely it's less expensive, indeed free, and in some cases, other than of course the massive labor and switching costs, than licensing these massive Office licenses from Microsoft.
Yep, and I mean, I'm just as an example, in my senior seminar in the spring semester, we're going to use Google Docs rather than the more conventional write it in Word and then, you know, send it to me or hand it in. Instead, I'm going to have them do all of their work in Google Docs.
Yeah, well, we'll have to keep an eye on this one. I think it's going to be a really big story. I mean, you know, of course, there's big questions that we brought up about online applications like Zoho, Office, or Google Apps, Google Docs, in terms of their readiness for the academic market. For instance, Google Docs doesn't really have a functioning footnoting system, which can be a rather big problem. It's really made much more for HTML kinds of documents. But certainly with USC doing this big move, with BC saying, you know what, we don't need to run an expensive email server, why don't we just get rid of that? You know, and again, in a financial situation that we're in, it seems like more and more you'd want to move to these lower cost cloud-based solutions.
I think another thing to watch, and this is maybe a larger issue and something a little further out. But in the same way that these technologies are starting, I think, to change the format and the expectations of what an academic conference is and means and looks like, I wonder if we're going to start to see some of these cloud services changing the nature of what a student paper looks like, whether the way that things are quoted and formatted and footnoted and some of those expectations are going to slowly, and I obviously these things change very slowly over time, but whether those will start changing as well. It's not as if the footnoting system that we use today, the Chicago Manual and all of that, has existed for all times and in all places. It has changed as the technology has changed, and I think we may be seeing over in the long term some of that as well.
It's a good point. But we have come to the number one big story, which I have to say. And that is, of course, mobile. Mobile technology really on the rise in 2008. We saw it coming early in 2007 with the launch of the iPhone. But in 2008, we saw a lot of developments on this front. Google, of course, released the open source Android handset operating system. We saw a first handset from T-Mobile with many more on the way, many other kinds of devices that will use Android. We saw a very successful launch of the Apple Mobile App Store and a similar kind of store from Google for Android. And I believe actually also Nokia was in the middle of setting up a kind of App Store for their next generation interface. And indeed, speaking of interfaces, I think part of what we'll have to discuss here with mobile is just these new kinds of interfaces, particularly the use of touch interfaces on mobile. Seems to us like 2009 will still be the year of mobile, right? Tom and Mills?
I think it will be, and I think in many ways it's the year of mobile, but it's also the year of convergence. I think a lot of you can look at a lot of these stories in our top 10 today, and you can see that things like the ebook readers, the netbooks, the cloud computing, all of those things speak to a kind of convergence where you can move easily between a mobile device, a laptop, a desktop, a netbook, and all of your stuff, all of these services are kind of the same, and they all exist in all of these places. And I think the really, in many ways, it's going to be that smallest device, the one you're carrying with you all of the time, that handset, is the thing that's going to really, really drive this convergence and tie it all together. So I think there's all these developments which are pointing towards the continued rise of mobile in 2009.
Right. It's got to be important that really mobile rolls in a lot of what we had in the top 10 this year. I mean, cloud computing, for instance, you can be on your Android handset and pull up your Google Doc that you were working on in class, or you can take a map you were working on with you out to a historic battlefield in Virginia, a Civil War battlefield. All these things kind of mix together, and you're just expecting to have everything on this one device that you're carrying with you all the time. And isn't that really the key part here, that the phone is something that, or whatever this device, I mean, I'm not sure if we really can call it a phone anymore, but it's sort of this one electronic device that's connected to the internet that you've got with you all the time, that you're taking into the library, you're taking it to a museum, so you want to use it in some way there, you're taking photos with it, you're messaging on it, you're communicating. That's why it's so critical, right? We've got it on us all the time, and so it's something that we're using more and more.
And I think that the other piece of this that then I think we're going to see a lot more of in 2009 is the ways of like sort of a further convergence beyond even what Tom talked about, which is also the making available a lot of these kind of super massive data sets through that mobile device, whether it's being able to read a book on your iPhone or having access to what has for a long time been kind of hard to access, geophysical data sets and GPS data, that sort of thing. So I think we're going to see increasing pressure to get at sort of the entire corpus of information that's available through these mobile devices. And I think that's going to put pressure on some of those who kind of tried to lock up some of that data.
Right, right.
Because people just expect now to have access to information right where they are.
I think the other thing, and I absolutely agree, Mills, and I think the other thing that points to is there's going to be pressure on the people who would lock up the device itself. I think that in 2009, I really think Android's an important development. I think Apple is going to see some increased pressure on them to open up the iPhone more. Right now, the App Store is still relatively closed. I mean, Apple is approving which applications get listed and which ones don't. The iPhone, developing for the iPhone, it's still a fairly closed environment. And I think having and it's one that's very much tailored to the kind of Mac experience where you're tying where you work on a MacBook and you have your iPhone as your mobile device. You're working in kind of that Apple ecosystem. I think Android's going to present a real challenge to that where, you've got this open netbook, which is running Linux. You've got this open handset, which is running Linux. You have maybe desktop Linux, which is starting to roll out. I think there's going to be some pressure in that space too. I mean, even Nokia has now released Symbian as an open source mobile operating system. So I think we're going to see some pressure both in open resources and in open technology. And I think the mobile and this kind of convergence is really pushing that.
Agreed all around. All right. Well, mobile, our number one story for 2008. And as a bonus to the year in review, we have our predictions for the next year, 2009. Tom, why don't we start with you? What's your prediction for 2009, a headline that you think we'll be talking about this time next year?
My headline for 2009 is Museums Catch Up. I think, one of the sad things of the kind of cultural heritage, educational technology space in the last, 10, 15 years has been the extent to which museums have really fallen, I think, behind libraries and archives and universities in the kind of technology they've been able to deploy. Nothing against museums. I'm kind of a museum guy myself. But I think that, for a lot of reasons, some of them financial, some of them due to the kind of unique nature of their collections where they're dealing with unique objects rather than sort of standardized objects like books, has prevented them from kind of doing as much with the technology as libraries and archives and universities have done. And I think that 2009 is going to be the year that they really start to come into their own in the web space and join the larger digital humanities and cultural heritage communities in adopting and advancing some standards that participating in the standards programs that are already out there, improving ties finally between their physical spaces and their digital environments, tying objects online to objects in the galleries, using some of those mobile technologies and cloud computing resources that we've talked about in the top 10. I think this is really the year for museums. I think people should really be watching what goes on in that space in 2009.
Okay, very good. Mills, what's your prediction for 2009?
My prediction is that 2009 is going to be the year of free.
TVs and beer and cars?
Yeah, right. That's right. No,
close to that, by the way, with the Great Depression.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. But Chris Anderson in Wired Magazine wrote about this earlier in the year, the rise of the free economy online. And that was when people actually had money to spend on things. And so now with what's happened in the economy, I think that if it ain't free, it ain't going to happen. And people are going to demand more and more free content. They're going to turn to things like cloud computing. It's, all of that stuff. I think it's just 2009. We're going to look back and say it was the year of free.
Okay. Yeah, I think it summarizes in many ways a lot of what we discussed on the podcast today. Well, for my prediction, I think I'll do the same thing, although I have a very concrete prediction. And it really does combine some of what's on our top 10 for this year. And that is that I think that I think Google is going to release a mobile version of Google Books that looks like Stanza or one of these good ebook readers for the iPhone or Android, so that when you go to books.google.com on your handset, you'll be able to just leaf through books. And my prediction is that that is going to have a tremendous impact on the way we access these libraries. That kind of reading it on a mobile device starts to kind of change the game. So I guess I'm cheating a little bit because this picks up on a lot of the themes we discussed today. But that's my prediction. They don't have a mobile version of Google Books yet, as they do for, say, Google Reader or Gmail. But I think they're probably going to figure out some way to resize this or use the OCR of the books that they can use to get it on smaller screens. And that will basically turn any handset into a 10 million book library. Thoughts on that?
It'd be huge if they did that. I mean, I think one of the problems I have personally with Google Books and one of the reasons why I think I'm a little ambivalent on this, but like why Google Books doesn't quite compete with the physical library and with the physical book is that it's the formatting. It's like hard to read Google Books. You can search around and find, a paragraph you're looking for or something, but to actually like sit down with Google Books and, enjoy the book is impossible at this point. But if they fix some of the formatting, and I think you're right, it's formatting for that handheld device, that would be a game changer. And I don't know if it will happen, but I hope to see it happen.
And I bet they wish they'd thought of the formatting issue before they started scanning all those books.
All right. Well, it's been a great year here on the podcast, Tom and Mills. Happy New Year. And I think all three of us wish our entire audience a very happy 2009. And we'll see you in the new year with another edition of Digital Campus. Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music. Ask not.